Well, I am glad you're here with us today. We're continuing through the book of Numbers. Last time we covered Numbers chapter 20, verse 14 through chapter 21, verse 9. And we saw the Israelites were there in Kadesh in the Negev area, and they made a request to Edom, which of course were descendants of Esau, to allow passage on toward the east, the northeast. And with that, they gave their testimony about Israel, Esau's brother being in hardship in Egypt, that they were treated poorly, that they were there a long time, and that they had cried out to the Lord and he'd sent an angel to bring them up out of Egypt. They made a pledge, we'll stay on the king's highway. We won't eat or drink anything from your land. And of course, that's important with the quantity of people that wanted to go through Edom. And do you remember what was Edom's answer? No, go away. Don't come through. So they asked again, and they added a promise to pay for water if they consumed any. And now how did Edom answer? They answered by not only saying no, but putting their army out there in front so that they were ready if they did come, that said, with strong force. We read in Deuteronomy how God had told Israel no quarreling with Edom, that he had promised Esau this land. And so Moses and Israel went around and found their way to Mount Hor without going through Edom. On Mount Hor, we saw that Aaron died. The garments were transferred to Eleazar, the official priestly garments. And so now Eleazar, Aaron's son, is the chief of the priests. And Israel stayed and wept there 30 days. And Arad, the Canaanite, was in the Negev, and he heard that Israel was traveling through, and so he attacked and took a few captives. So Israel went to the Lord and asked the Lord to deliver the Canaanites to them, that if he did, they would utterly destroy them and their cities. And God did offer them up. He did say go. And so they did bring this ultimate destruction to the Canaanites. And we talked about the Canaanites and their descending from the time of Noah and Ham. And the grumbling began. As soon as that's over, why are we out here? They got tired of the length of the journey. They got tired of the food. They even called this food terrible that they were being given, of course, which was God's own provision in the manna. And then so the Lord sent serpents. And the people recognized their sin. They named their sin. They said, yes, we are guilty. They asked Moses to ask God to remove the snakes. And because many were dying from these poisonous snakes. And what did God do? Did he take away the snakes? What did he do? It was eventually going to be, it's made of brass. God asked Moses to put the form of a serpent up on a standard, on a staff, and then the people that would look at that would be saved from dying. And it took an intentional look, required some faith. And so the snakes, as far as we know, stayed with them, but the threat of death was gone for those that would exercise their faith by looking to the staff. And that all pointed to Jesus on the cross. Jesus himself said, just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, that he himself would have to be lifted up and that those that looked on him would live. That's from John chapter 3. And we spent some time looking at that parallel that's going on there. So that takes us to where we're going to start today, which is Numbers chapter 21. And I'm going to begin by reading verses 10 through 20. Now the sons of Israel moved out and camped at Oboth. They journeyed from Oboth and camped at Ayer-Barim in the wilderness, which is opposite Moab to the east. From there they sent out and camped in Wadi Zered, From there they journeyed and camped on the other side of Arnon, which is in the wilderness that comes out of the border of the Amorites. For Arnon is on the border of Moab, between Moab and the Amorites. Therefore it is said in the book of the wars of the Lord, Wahab in Suphah, and the wadis of the Arnon, and the slope of the wadis that extends to the side of Ar and leads to the border of Moab. From there they continued to Beer, that is the well where the Lord said to Moses, Assemble the people that I may give them water. Then Israel sang this song, Spring up, O well, sing to it. The well which the leaders sank, which the nobles of the people dug with the scepter and with their staffs. And from the wilderness they continued to Mattanah, and from Mattanah to Nahaliel, and from Nahaliel to Bamoth, and from Bamoth to the valley that is in the land of Moab at the top of Pisgah, which overlooks the wasteland. Okay, challenging for me because of some of the words, but also because of all of these locations. And so Israel moved, and they moved through several places. And unfortunately, trying to locate these places is really difficult in our era. But they went to a place called Oboth, and from there they went to Lai Abarim in the wilderness also opposite Moab. I passed out another map this morning that did a little better job of showing some of these places. So you can see that Moab there is to the east of the Dead Sea. And so they're up in that region of Moab, and I lost my place here in my notes for a second. And so, there we are. And so they're up there east of the, probably east of Moab, or maybe to the northeast of Moab. They went to Wadi Zered. A wadi is a valley or a stream bed that only runs with the rains. It's dry when there's not rains, and there's water there when there is. And so that's where they were, was a wadi named Zered. And they went on to Arnon, which is a wilderness on the border of the Amorites. Well, if you look, Ammon, the Ammonite area, is north there of Moab. And they then they turn to the Book of Wars. What is the Book of Wars? Well, we can only guess by what we've seen here. It's not something that was saved like Scripture, but clearly was written at some point that about all of the events that went on. And so we get the quotes there in the Book of the Wars about their moving around. That's there in verses 14 and 15. And when we read it, they talked about Wahab and Suphah and the wadis of the Arnon and the slope of the wadis that extends to the site of Ar and leans to the border of Moab. So they're somewhere near Moab, and this valley tends to lean, the one part of it at least would be leaning down toward Moab. So they're still in that general area, and I'm sure that had great meaning to them. They wrote it down, it was significant, but it's hard to put much on it today. But we do get the idea of where they're traveling around. They're up there in that area north of Moab and south of Ammon, or Ammonite in all probability. And from there they go to Beer. And when you first read that, I read it and said, oh, so this is a place where God had already called them together and put a well in. And that's really not the case. We see that in verse 16. It's a place where the Lord said to Moses, Ascend to the people that I may give them water. So apparently this giving them water was the digging of a well. And so God led them to this place. They dug the well there. And verses 17 and 18 causes them, it tells of the song that they sang and the way they rejoiced over this well. Spring up, O well, sing to it, the well which the leaders sank, which the nobles of the people dug with the scepter and with their staff. So it was a place that they could have continuous water. It wasn't depending on current rains and that kind of a thing. It was a well they could draw from and sustain their camping there. And so they had this song, and then they went to Matanah. And this takes us through a few more cities or towns or areas, from Matanah to Nahaliel, and then Baamoth, and then Baamoth to the valley in Moab at the top of Pisgah, which overlooks the wasteland. And so where they have been stationed is they are now in an area that is between Ammon and Moab. Up there, just to the east in some area, we're going to find out a little more detail about one of their locations in a bit, but they're to the east of the Jordan River, and they're in an area that borders both of these areas. So I know that was a pretty brief description, but any questions or comments with that? Okay, well, let's go ahead and look at verses 21 through 35, because their positioning and the events lead them to some very interesting activities here. So beginning in verse 21, "Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, saying, 'Let me pass through your land. We will not turn off unto the field or the vineyard. We will not drink water from wells. We will go by the king's highway until we have passed through your border.' But Sihon would not permit Israel to pass through his border. So Sihon gathered all his people and went out against Israel in the wilderness and came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. Then Israel struck him with the edge of the sword and took possession of his land from the Arnon to the Jabbok, as far as the sons of Ammon, for the border of the sons of Ammon was Jazer. Israel took all these cities, and Israel lived in all these cities of the Amorites, in Heshbon and in all her villages. For Heshbon was the city of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab and had taken all his land out of his hand as far as the Arnon. Therefore, those who use proverbs say, 'Come to Heshbon, let it be built. So let the city of Sihon be established.' For a fire went forth from Heshbon, a flame from the town of Sihon. It devoured Ar of Moab, the dominant heights of the Arnon. Woe to you, Moab! You are ruined, O people of Chemosh. He has given his sons as fugitives and his daughters into captivity to an Amorite king, Sihon. But we have cast them down. Heshbon is ruined as far as Dibon. Then we have laid waste even to Nopah, which reaches to Medeba. Thus Israel lived in the land of the Amorites. Moses sent a spy out to Jazer, and they captured its villages and dispossessed the Amorites who were there. Then they turned and went up by the way of Bashan, and Og, the king of Bashan, went out with all his people for battle at Edrei. But the Lord said to Moses, 'Do not fear him, for I have given him into your hand, and all his people and his land, and you shall do to him as you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived at Heshbon.' So they killed him and his sons and all his people until there was no remnant left him, and they possessed his land." So Israel gets involved with a couple of battles here with a couple of nations, or at least people groups. And so Israel wants to go through the Ammonite area. They want to get north. God is getting ready to station them up along the Jordan River. Remember, we're at the end of the 40 years, so they're getting ready. And God's going to disperse them along that river and put them in the right position for what he plans to do to let them take the land of Canaan, the promised land. So they say, "Let us pass through," and they pass through, and they make the same promise. "We'll stay on the path, we'll stay on the king's highway, we won't drink the water." And of course, we answered that last week. Why is that important?
Millions of people.
2 million people, about, is what we think was there. Drinking your water's going to get stressed and maybe run out. Now, Sihon was the king of the Amorites, and he said no, and he gathered all his people to go to war with Israel in the wilderness to Jahaz. And Jahaz is apparently a northern, a southern city about where they were. And so they go up against Israel, but Israel defeated them and took their cities, including Heshbon, which was their capital city. It was a city where Sihon lived, and then the villages. And as a result, they were living in the land of the Amorites. They pretty much took it over. That became their dwelling, including Heshbon, which was King Sihon's city. And he had taken all of this land from the king of Moab. And we're going to get some information about that, why that is important to what we're talking about. But the Proverbs build up about when Sihon took Moab. And it's part of their lore, their history. And in verse 27 through 29, you see the prose there. For those who use Proverbs say, come to Heshbon, let it be built. Heshbon is their capital city. Let the city of Sihon be established, for a fire went forth from Heshbon, a flame from the town of Sihon, and it devoured Ar of Moab, the dominant heights of Arnon. Woe to you, Moab, you're ruined. O people of Chemosh, he has given his sons as fugitives and his daughters into captivity to an Amorite king, Sihon. But we have cast them down. Heshbon is ruined as far as Dibon. Then we have laid waste even to Nophah, which reaches to Medeba. And so this is a story of how Sihon came with the Amorites and booted Moab out of this area that we now call the land of the Amorites at the time that this is occurring. And the passage here makes quite a big deal about that, that it was a big defeat for Moab, and they were pushed out. The capital city became then the capital city of Sihon instead of an important city for Moab, and they're all pushed out. Their people are taken captive, and they are overrun, and the Amorites take that as their own place and make it their own. Well, why is that so important? Well, let's go over to verse Deuteronomy 2:9. Let's look at Deuteronomy 2:9 for a minute. And this is why that's important. Or at least as a hint of why that's important. This is the Deuteronomy account of the wanderings. And it says here, Moses is writing, the Lord said to me, do not harass Moab, nor provoke him to war, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession, because I have given Ar to the sons of Lot as a possession. And the Moabites are descendants then of Lot. And so this is Lot's area, and they're saying, don't mess with the Moabites. I've given them their land. Well, when the land was given, it included this area that they've just captured. And so the book of Numbers is making a point about the fact that this is no longer Moabite land. They're not violating that prohibition when they go to war with the Ammonites and take the land, because it's no longer a part of Moab's possession. The Ammonites ran them off. And so as they run the Ammonites off, as they go to war with them, as we see down beginning in verse 31, then they live there, but they have not gone against God's directions about leaving the Moabites alone. So then in verse 32, Moses sent men to spy out Jazer, which is on the border, and they captured the villages there and took and dispossessed the Ammonites there, so they're continuing to take the Ammonite ground. And they went up by the way of Bashan to Og, the king of the north. And he went out to battle Israel at Edrei. So now we have another attack coming. This Og is also an Amorite king. That was an Amorite area up where Og was. And you can see that on the map. They guessed where it was, the kingdom of Og, up there just east of the Sea of Galilee. And so now they're doing battle with them. And God tells him, don't worry about it. What you did to Sihon will be done to the kingdom that Og is in charge of, because I've given him over to you just as I did the Amorites. Which is something to take note of here, is that God is providing their victories. Yes, they're a big nation for the time and for the place, and they have lots of warriors and so on, but it is really God that is providing for this, as we've seen in other situations where they did battle. So the king of Og and his sons and all his people are killed. There's no one left, and the Israelites possess the land, which is basically now all of the eastern shore of the Jordan River. God has established them in that area. Yeah, this is the map that's back there, if you didn't grab one. It's a little easier to see what we're talking about today than the one I handed out a couple of weeks ago. And so now Israel is there poised along the eastern shore, occupying the land of the Amorites. And where they needed to be, wanted to be, where God wanted them to be, and they are in a good position. Questions or comments?
We've got a question, because it says that they were dwelling in these places too. So as the Israelites conquest, like they're in their conquest of the Holy Land, is it almost as if, like, as they're taking over, they're progressively occupying those areas as well? Because, you know, if you think about any kind of like sovereign nation, you have to have, like, you know, actionable borders, you have to have, you know, a local government of some sort. So like if they're taking over in these areas, there have to be a remnant left. So as we move on forward through the conquest, like, are we assuming that a fraction of the folks stay in these particular
Here's what's going to happen. Looking at big picture, some of this is in Numbers, some of it's other places, and then we'll run into it right in the face in Joshua. They're settling in this area. They are not yet ready. God hasn't reformed the younger group to move into Israel. And so this is the place where they're living, and yes, they are in dominion over it. For the most part, they have wiped out the people that were there. So what's going to happen when they get ready to go in? Well, a couple of the tribes are going to say, we like it here, we're going to stay here. And a deal is struck between the 12 tribes that, yes, we're going to retain some tribal occupation east of the Jordan. But you guys east of the Jordan, you're going to come help, and you're going to be involved in the conquest. And we get the conquest done, then you can go back. And so there's some agreement coming. So in generally, that's what's happening. God's gathering them together, but they will be retaining some of this area that they've taken for the tribes as they move on in. Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions, comments?
you mentioned that they took the land from the Amorites,
mm-hmm.
but not from the Moabites, because the Amorites had taken over from the Moabites, is that right?
Yeah, the Amorites had previously driven the Moabites.
And it sounded like they were not supposed to take the land from the Moabites?
Let's go back to Deuteronomy. Let's go back and just look at that again. Deuteronomy 2:9, and see just how it gets said, because it's pretty specific about what their limitations are. Deuteronomy 2:9. I'll get there. Oh, come on. All right, Deuteronomy 2:9 said, the Lord said to me, do not harass Moab, nor provoke them to war. For I will not give you any of their land as a possession, because I have given Ar to the sons of Lot as a possession. So their job is to not start anything. And when they're all done, they're not going to get the land of the Moabites. So in a sense, God is saying, there's no profit in it for you anyway. I'm not going to give it to you. So just leave them alone. And don't start something with them, because we're just getting ready to read about how something got started with them. Yeah, it's going to come pretty hard. Well, with that then, let's go over to Numbers chapter 22, And we're going to read the first 12 verses. Then the sons of Israel journeyed and camped in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan opposite Jericho. Now Balak, son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. Excuse me. So Moab was in great fear because of the people, for they were numerous. And Moab was in dread of the sons of Israel. Moab said to the elders of Midian, "Now this horde will lick up all that is around us. And as the ox licks up the grass of the field, and Balak the son of Zippor was king of Moab at that time." So he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the sons of his people, to call him, saying, "Behold, a people has come out of Egypt. Behold, they cover the surface of the land, and they are living opposite me. Now, therefore, please come curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I may be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the fees for the divination in their hands, and they came to Balaam and repeated Balak's words to him. And he said to them, "Spend the night here, and I will bring word back to you as the Lord may speak to me." And the leaders of Moab stayed with Balaam. Then God came to Balaam and said, "Who are these men with you?" Balaam said to God, "Balak, the son of Zippor, the king of Moab, has sent word to me. Behold, there's a people who came out of Egypt, and they cover the surface of the land. Now come curse them for me. Perhaps I may be able to fight against them and drive them out." God said to Balaam, "Do not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed." We're going to be spending some time now in the interaction between Balak and Balaam and these other folks from the Midianite area that have come in. But we see there in verse 1, Israel came and camped in the plains of Moab. So they're down there on the north border of Moab in a plain area. They say they're beyond Jordan. So this is written from a perspective of the promised land. So beyond Jordan, they're east of the Jordan, opposite Jericho. And Jericho is not on your map, but it's at the northern tip on the west side of the Jordan, the northern tip of the Dead Sea. And so they're just opposite there. And so here they are, they're camping, at least a portion of them, a big portion, because of how Balak responds. And Balak was the son of Zippor. So I looked to find out, well, what's the significance of being the son of Zippor? And all I could come up with is Balak was the son of Zippor. I couldn't find much reference to Zippor elsewhere. It might have been my poor research, I don't know, but there was certainly no previous mention of Zippor in the scriptures. And he had seen what Israel had done to the Amorites. So what was his reaction to seeing what Israel had done to the Amorites? What's that? He was full of fear. I mean, he was really full of fear. Verse 3 says that he looked at the number of Israelites was big, and he had great dread. He expected to be overrun and defeated. He was not having some sort of an idea that, well, maybe we can survive. He knew that if they came after him, he was in trouble. So where does Moab turn to when he saw he was in trouble? It's there in verse 4. At least it's his first action. Turns to Midian. So let's remind ourselves, where is Midian compared to Moab? What's that?
South.
Go south, you'll hit Midian. Matter of fact, it's not too far from the mountain where all of God came down and talked to the people and so on. And so he turns to them. And so, matter of fact, what it says in verse 4, he said to the elders of Midian, This horde will lick up all that is around us, just like the ox licks up the grass of the field. And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of Moab at that time. In other words, here's the king of Moab turning the Midianites going, hey, you know, we got troubles. They're here. They're going to take everything all around us, and they're going to isolate us, and we're going to be in peril. And, of course, what's the implication then as he turns to the Midianites? What's he implying he wants them to do?
Join him in battle.
Yeah, join me. I don't want to do this by myself. This is the typical fear thing. I'm afraid of the dark. I don't want to go down the stairs in the basement. You go with me and we'll turn the light on together. That kind of a thing. You know, he's scared. And he's expecting defeat, and he wants to hopes that Midian will be some sort of help with him. But he has another piece of a plan, too. So he's got some Midianites there with him, and what action does he take there in verse 5? Yeah, he sends a delegation. Who's in the delegation? What two nations are represented? Moab, right?
And Moab, Midian.
And Midian. And so they're together. And where do they go? They go to Balaam, the son of Beor. And I didn't learn a lot about what it meant to be the son of Beor either, but he's at Pethor, which is believed to be near the river Euphrates. And they give a very specific message. And the message is, behold, a people out of Egypt. Now that behold is, hey, pay attention, this is a big deal. There's a people out of Egypt, and they cover the land, and they're living opposite of me. That's the problem. There's all these people there, and they're just everywhere. There's lots of them. And he has a requested solution, and he wants Balaam to please come and curse them for me. They are too mighty for me, but maybe with the curse. That's not said, but with the curse part. But he said, maybe I can drive them out. And he affirms this, I know who you bless is blessed, and those you curse are cursed. So what is he saying about Balaam when he makes that statement? I know that when you curse people, they're cursed, and when you bless people, they're blessed. Or somebody, he's got a power. The word divination gets used before we're done. And so is his power from what we would call God? I've started in my own personal life using the Legacy Bible, which doesn't say God everywhere. It will say Yahweh in most cases. It says Yahweh. I like Jehovah a little better, but that's just personal preference. We don't know how it should really be said. But he will talk about Yahweh and Elohim as the names of God, particularly in this chapter. And I like that because when you say God in today's world, you can say God to a Muslim and they might think you mean Yahweh, right? Or Yahweh. They might think you mean Allah, right? And so when we start being distinguishing and using the real names, I think it brings some clarification. But he's got some sort of connection with power beyond what the normal person has. And out of that power, Balak is convinced that his curses mean something and his blessings mean something, and it results in either blessing or cursing for the people. So in verse 7, the elders of both Media, the Median elders and the Moabite elders, they left with the money to buy the divination. That tells you, that just gives you a problem right out of the box, doesn't it? Is Balaam a good prophet? No, before we're done, I think we're going to see a lot of things that are revealing about the typical false prophet. Now, Balaam does a couple things that are interesting in this event and story, but before the whole story of Balaam is done, it's clear that he is a false prophet, and he will even bring misdirection and pull Israel into sin. But that's a couple chapters away yet. So they go there, and they're going to buy this cursing. So Balaam, obviously, was a prophet for sale. And they apparently knew enough about him being a prophet for sale to have a pretty good idea of how much money it took to get him to be a part of their scheme. So they come and they give that message, and Balaam has a response. You spend the night, and I will bring word back to you as, and he uses the word Yahweh or Jehovah here, as Yahweh tells me or Jehovah tells me. And, you know, it's an interesting question. Why would he say Jehovah here? Why is he thinking about Jehovah? Would Jehovah be a common thing for him? Well, if we stop and think a minute, there's a lot of generations have gone by, but all of the people we're talking about have a link to Abraham. Either through Lot or through Esau. I mean, we've got the Canaanites. They're linked back through Moses. I'm sorry, through Noah. I mean, these folks all are so many generations closer to seeing God at work through the flood and through the establishment of Abraham. They know their heritage. I mean, a Moabite is going to talk about his link back through Esau, and others are going to talk about their link back through Abraham. The Midianites, what's their link back to Abraham? Remember? Moses had a whole nother family after, I'm sorry, Abraham had a whole nother family after Sarah. And these are the descendants of his second wife that went down and established the Midian. And so here they are, all having links, all having history of Jehovah. And I don't know if Jehovah was in the practice of talking to Balaam ever before or not, but he did hear. And so he goes and seeks out Jehovah. And God says to him, and it's interesting, the name for God here is Elohim. This is God Almighty. This is the, yes, sir.
Is that other family of Abraham, is that Ishmael?
No.
Sarah?
No. Ishmael was before Sarah, but well, Ishmael was before Jacob with the handmaiden that Sarah brought. Okay. I've got Zipporah in my head, and that's Moses' wife.
Keturah
was Abraham's second wife. And the descendants through Keturah went down and established the Midian nation. But God comes to him and says, who are these people? And Balak just gives him the message that he got as they came in. And he says that in verse 10, he says, Balak, the son of Zippor. Now that shows us something there. Who's in the lead in this whole process? Balak. It's the Moabites that are leading. The Midianites are kind of trailing on here. But the king of Moab has sent word to me. And he tells him about their people that came out of Egypt. And he wants me to curse them so that perhaps he might be able to fight against them and drive them out. And so he tells God about Balak's fear and these people being there and so on. What does God tell Balaam?
Don't go with them.
Don't go. Why? Well, you're not to curse the people because they
are blessed.
This is a past tense. It's an interesting thing. They're already blessed. What's the main blessing on these people? Abraham, make you a great nation. Those that bless you, I'll bless. Those that curse you, I'll curse. So he inquired of God, and God said, don't go. Let it be. It's not a part of what you're to be a part of. And so that's the answer that Balaam gets. And that took us through verse 12. So let's go ahead and look at verses. Questions, comments? Let's look at verses 13 through 21. So God said to Balaam, I'm sorry, that's 12. Don't go with him. Verse 13. So Balaam arose in the morning and said to Balak's leaders, go back to your land, for the Lord has refused to let me go with you. The leaders of Moab arose and went to Balak and said, Balaam refused to come with us. Then Balak again sent the leaders, more numerous and more distinguished than the former. They came to Balaam and said to him, thus says Balak, the son of Zippor, let nothing, I beg you, hinder you from coming to me. For I will indeed honor you richly, and I will do whatever you say to me. Please come then, curse this people for me. Balaam replied to the servants of Balak, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not do anything, either small or great, contrary to the command of the Lord my God. Now, please, you also stay here tonight, and I will find out what else the Lord will speak to me. God came to Balaam at night and said to him, if the men have come to call you, rise up and go with them, but only the word which I speak to you shall you do. So Balaam arose in the morning and saddled his donkey and went with the leaders of Moab. So they go back to Balak after Balaam has said, Jehovah said, no, I'm not going with you. So they go back to Balak and they just say, what do they say to Balak? Well, no, what did they say to Balak when they get back? What?
Balaam said no.
What did they leave out?
Because
Jehovah said so. They don't bother with that. They just tell him he won't come. So Balak says, no problem. He doesn't say that. But he sends more leaders and they're more impressive men back to Balaam. And so we find out the message when they get there. They say that Balak said, let nothing hinder you from coming to me. In other words, in verse 17, he says, I'll pay you well and do anything you say. Please come curse these people. And so they think they can be more convincing to Balaam to come by what? What did they add to the request? What?
Money,
and also prominent people. You know, you get the personal visit from people higher up the chain, and they say, don't let anything hinder you. In other words, here's the check. I've signed it. You fill it in however you want, and you come. What's Balaam's response? Verse 18. If that's all Balaam ever said or did, we could endorse Balaam, couldn't we?
Yeah.
He says, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold. Now, this is going to be quite the deal. So he's going to a very extreme example that's beyond reason, but it's what he's trying to say. Give me his house full of silver and gold. I couldn't do anything, whether it be something small or something great, that is different than the command of Jehovah, my God. And did he speak a truth?
Yeah.
He sure did. Can you do anything that Jehovah decides you're not going to do? No. So it's practical, it's truthful, and it sounds worshipful, doesn't it? But we're going to find out before we're done with Balaam that it's not. And maybe in this moment, he's honoring God, but he's giving them the truth. If we can't get Jehovah on to give us something to do, we can't do anything. He says, but spend the night. I'll go back to Jehovah, and I will see what else he will tell me. So in verse 20, God came again, and he says, if the men have come to you, rise up and go with them. So they're here. Go with them. But what's his prohibition?
Only do what I tell you to do.
Only my words to you are to be followed. So in the morning, in verse 21, Balaam gets up and goes with the men toward Balak, toward Moab. Questions, comments? Well, let's look at 22 through 35. So Balaam has left, and then we get over to verse 22. But God was angry because he was going, and the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as an adversary against him. Now he was riding on his donkey, and his two servants were with him. When the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand, the donkey turned off from the way and went into the field. But Balaam struck the donkey to turn her back into the way. Then the angel of the Lord stood in a narrow path of the vineyards with a wall on his side and a wall on that side. When the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she pressed herself to the wall and pressed Balaam's foot against the wall, so he struck her again. The angel of the Lord went further and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn to the right hand or to the left. When the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she lay down under Balaam. So Balaam was angry and struck the donkey with his stick. And the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey, and she said to Balaam, "What have I done to you that you have struck me these three times?" Then Balaam said to the donkey, "Because you have made a mockery of me. If there had been a sword in my hand, I would have killed you by now." The donkey said to Balaam, "Am I not your donkey on which you have ridden all your life to this day? Have I ever been accustomed to do so to you?" And he said, "No." Then the Lord opened the eyes of Balaam, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand, and he bowed all the way to the ground. The angel of the Lord said to him, "Why have you struck your donkey these three times? Behold, I have come out as an adversary because your way was contrary to me." But the donkey saw me and turned aside from me these three times. If she'd not turned aside from me, I would have surely killed you just now and let her live. Balaam said to the angel of the Lord, "I have sinned, for I did not know that you were standing in the way against me. Now then, if it is displeasing to you, I will turn back." But the angel of the Lord said to Balaam, "Go with the men, but you shall speak only the word which I tell you." So Balaam went along with the leaders of Balak. One of the fantastic accounts in the scriptures. But God was angry because he was going. Now, didn't God just tell him to go? So what's with this anger? Why would God be angry?
We can infer that it probably has to do with the qualifier that he adds at the end, and only do what I tell you.
There's some of that.
He's really not going with the right mind.
Probably not going with the right mind. Yeah, have you ever had a kid when they said, "Can I have?" and you said no, and 10 minutes later they're back, "Can I have that?" I mean, after a while you go, "What did I tell you?" I think there's a certain element here of God already answered the question once, and here they are back again. "Why, Balaam, are you down here wanting to know what I want you to do? Didn't I already tell you? Oh, fine then, go." I don't know about God's attitude, and I don't want to put my own thoughts into that, but I can certainly see the possibility that that was frustrating, was angering to God. And so he's angry, and an angel of Jehovah is in the path against Balaam. And Balaam's there on his donkey with two servants. And those two servants are part of this story more than you might realize. So the donkey's going along, and who's the only one that can see the angel of the Lord standing in the path with the sword?
The donkey.
The donkey. I find that just fascinating. I don't know what to do with it, but it's very fascinating. It's clearly how God wanted to get his message to Balaam. And so the donkey sees the angel in the way, sees the drawn sword, and he left the path, went into a field. So Balaam struck the donkey to turn her back. And they go a little further, and the angel's in the way again, this time between two walls. And so the donkey sees the angel again, and the donkey pressed against one of the walls, trapping Balaam's foot there. That probably wasn't very pleasant, was it? And so he started to hit her. And so apparently the angel, not apparently, the angel moves down the road. And so they're back going again. And the angel stops in a narrow place where there's nowhere else to go. The donkey sees the angel and shows more intelligence than Balaam has at this point. But he sees the angel and he lays down under Balaam. Now, this is an experience. I have experienced this. My cousins had a little Shetland pony. And Shetland ponies are very, very strong-willed, at least most of them. I didn't like horses, but I had some experience with horses. I was older than my cousins, and they were trying to get this horse to quit doing weird things. And the weird things, the biggest weird thing it liked to do was roll on you. It'd trap your leg under him, and he'd, I don't know if it was a him or a her, but anyhow, and in this rolling motion, leave you laying in the grass, probably if you were young, as my cousins were crying, and the horse is off doing his own thing. Wasn't a very big horse. And I was, I don't know, 10 or so, and so they asked me if I'd try to ride her, and I did. And when the horse decided to roll with me, and she'd always speed up right before she did it, so you knew it was coming. But I was just tall enough as she rolled, I could spread my feet out, and so all she did was wind up rolling under me. But anyhow, every time I read that, I think about that. And it's a very frustrating thing. You dumb horse, get up here. What are you doing? I'm in charge, don't you know that? And of course, in reality, that horse was always in charge. I don't think anybody ever mastered that horse. But nonetheless, here's this donkey just laid down under Balaam. Now, Balaam is not happy. And so he starts striking this horse, this donkey with a stick. And because of who Balaam is, I find the story very believable, but I wouldn't believe it with hardly anybody else. Jehovah opens the donkey's mouth, and the donkey starts arguing with Balaam. What have I done to you that makes me deserve your striking me? And this is the part that's just so fantastic. Balaam clearly was in tune with another world, because if a donkey started talking to you, are you going to talk back? I mean, seriously, he answers this donkey, and he doesn't say, I'm in charge, you're not doing what I'm telling you, you're being a poor horse, I've trained you better. He doesn't talk about, I'm on a path here, we want to go down the path, what do you, no, what does he say? You've made a mockery of me. In front of who? Who was there to see it? His two servants. I don't know if he'd have given a different answer if those servants weren't there, but he's embarrassed that this donkey's not doing what he said. Now, okay, that's fine. He probably told the truth. But if the donkey starts talking to you, that's, I still think, a very strange answer unless you're Balaam. And he goes on to say, well, if I had a sword, I would have killed you. Trying to have an argument now with this donkey about, I really should be doing worse to you than just striking you. I'm really being kind by that's all I'm doing. And the donkey then says, am I not your donkey? You've ridden me all your life. Is this my normal behavior? And Balaam says, well, no. At that moment, the Lord lets Balaam see the angel of Jehovah in the path with a sword in his hand. Balaam responds somewhat properly. What does he do? Bowed to the ground. I when I read that, unless he was very limber, I think he winds up prostrated on the ground. And the angel has a question now. Why have you struck your donkey these three times? And then he doesn't wait for an answer. He says, behold, pay attention. I've come in opposition. Your way is against me. God is making it clear you're not really on my team. Your donkey saw me and turned around aside these three times. If she hadn't turned around, if she'd have kept coming, I would have killed you and let her live. That's a pretty strong statement from an angel. Your animal was fine. It isn't her fault. It's your fault. And so the insight here is that God is clearly in charge of these events, and he wants Balaam to know it. And the donkey through Jehovah's a better than you at being understanding and a witness. Gave the donkey more spiritual insight sooner than he did Balaam. And he says, I gave the donkey words. And so Jehovah can use anyone or anything how he wants. Think about when they asked Jesus during the triumphal entry to tell the people to be quiet. What was his answer? If they didn't, the rocks would be praising me. And that makes that just very clear. He wasn't just using an example. Well, Balaam said, if I've sinned, I have sinned. I didn't know you were standing against me. I'll turn back if proceeding displeases you. And the angel said, no, go with the men. But, and he gets the same admonition, speak only the word that I tell you. And Balaam went with them. Questions, thoughts, comments?
In verse 32, where he says, because your way was contrary to me, that's what this messenger is saying. Wouldn't that kind of say that, wouldn't you have said, because your way was contrary to Yahweh, and would this be a physical manifestation of Yahweh, i.e. the second person of the Trinity?
It very well could be second person of the Trinity. Angel of the Lord, your ways against me. Very probable. I don't know if I could say that I know for certain, but it's definitely in that category of those kinds of events.
The anger of the, the Lord, it does seem strange that he sends him and then he's angry with him. Would that possibly be tied to the money that he receives from this? I mean,
it could be. It could be. You know, you're out here being a prophet for, you're being a prophet of God for profited money. And it very well could be. I mean, I think it still goes back somewhat to that first encounter. God said, don't go. And I think that that was, I think God was offended that he's back asking again, and now he's off even going for money, apparently going for money. God told him to go along, and we assume that he accepted the funds or would accept the funds when the time came, that he expected a prominent place as a result of doing all this. Yeah, clearly this is not a prophet that God is going to endorse. And even though occasionally he says some things that are good, right, and correct, he's not a prophet of God. He's a prophet for his own benefit.
Rick, I was just thinking about how oftentimes in like our lives, the temptation usually starts with questioning, right? And then it's putting yourself in a position where you're allowing yourself to, like, you know, fall to temptation or whatever. And so, like, I think in this situation, you have God answering very clearly no, and then basically just allowing him to reap what he's sowing in his own heart. And I think that, like, when the Lord, and this is my interpretation, when the Lord lets him go, do only what I tell you, God knows that the intentions and the, like, devices of Balaam's heart are going to be evil, and he knows what's going to happen. But also, in his grace, he allows him to have stages where, you know, you see him deteriorate. And so I think that's kind of what's happening.
And the other thing that's happening here is God is reinforcing with Balaam, and this will be important later, don't get off the track. Only do what I tell you to do. And that's going to be important to the rest of these events as they come together. Balaam's going reminds me of the time that God gave the quail to the Israelites. I'm going to give them so much quail. It's going to be coming out their noses. That's literally what God said. I'm going to put them everywhere. They're going to be everywhere. They're going to be their feet deep. I don't remember how deep they were, but it was something. So
I don't know. You're kind of saying it's like this, you know, how common of an occurrence is this for Balaam that he just didn't pay attention to a donkey talk to him? I always thought, like, it's probably not common, but he is just so unbelievably, insanely mad at the situation that he's not even going to stop and say, oh, there's a donkey talking to him. No, he's mad.
Yep.
Like, on a mission, furious.
Yep. All right, well, we'll pick it up in verse 36 next time. And thank you for being here.